A 1980s comic strip told the story of a teenage Tommy who fought in the Somme and Passchendaele and across the Western Front. More than four decades later, what does Charlie's War tell us about the old front line? Welcome back to Season 6 of the Old Frontline podcast. We're coming into our fourth year of this podcast now, which is quite amazing. And I think that in the first few episodes of this season, we will tip the 1 million download mark. And that really, from something that started during the pandemic when we couldn't visit those battlefields of the Great War, that is really quite incredible. And just a few days ago, we had one of our regular supporters' evenings, and it was good to see so many of you there. And I realised what a fantastic community that we've built up through this podcast. And here we all are, fascinated and passionate about the history of the Great War, a group of like-minded friends. And that is a really great feeling as we move on into this season, a season which I hope we'll cover a lot of diverse subjects, as we've done with previous seasons on the podcast. And we're starting this week with the first of a couple of looks at graphic novels of the First World War. Now, we could just do one episode on graphic novels and dip into quite a few, and there will be a follow-up episode to this where we'll look at some different graphic novels from different countries. But I wanted to focus on one particular novel, one particular story really in this podcast, one that had a great effect on me and my pathway to the Great War, and that's Charlie's War, which was a children's comic strip from the late 1970s and early 1980s. And I often feel that for many of us, and I'm sure those of you listening will feel this too, that there are many gateways to the First World War, the ways that we come to it. A common one is family history, and that's probably behind probably all of us one way or another. But there are things that kind of pique our interests. It can be films, it can be literature, it can be war poetry, it can be the wider kind of study of the war. But for young minds drawn into the history of the Great War, and my young mind growing up in the 70s being fascinated with it, it was a period when there were a lot of modelling and wargaming magazines and tons of kind of books on military history, and I was lucky that I had a very good local library in my old hometown of Crawley where I could go to, and there were just endless books on it. But one of the things that really, really pulled me in to the human side of the Great War was this comic strip, Charlie's War. And it is something that I will always cite as one of my major, major influences when it comes to my connection to the history of the Great War. Because, you know, I read a lot of books about equipment, about the battles of the First World War. My grandmother told me the stories of her cousins who marched off the war. All of that was kind of part of this period. And in 1979, I began to understand what battlefield visiting was all about when I went to Normandy for the first time with my dad. And reading some of those modelling and wargaming magazines, there were often articles about travelling to the battlefields. I remember Graham Maddox, and I've probably mentioned this in a podcast before, writing about walking the Somme at Montauban in the footsteps of a Liverpool pal who he'd interviewed. And all of that kind of really fed, I think, my interest. But Charlie's War gave me something different. This was the story of a young soldier on the Western Front, and I think it gave a new dimension. We often talk about layers of the First World War, and I think for me this was perhaps building one of those very first layers of understanding and connection and interest in the kind of wider subject of just the battles and the guns and the bombs, the bullets and the bayonets. So what was Charlie's War? The 1970s, for those of you who grew up in that period in Britain, it was a golden age of children's comics. I mean, there were all sorts of comics looking at kind of everything. For many boys, Victor comic, which was kind of a football and sporty and military comic, which had stories of Victoria Cross recipients on the front cover and so on, that was one. But I was never that keen on Victor. And then Battle Comic came along with all kinds of stories of like Johnny Reb, the fighter pilot on the Eastern Front in World War II. And there were the small little Battle Comics, Commando Comics that you often get when you're on holiday. There'll be news agents around the corner from the campsite or from the caravan site where you go and pick some of these up, and that would be your holiday reading. But very few of these had First World War stories in them. And then in January 1979, a new comic strip appeared in Battle Picture Weekly, which was one of these many comics from that 1970s period. It later became Battle Action Comic. For me, this, I think, as I've said, was probably one of the greatest single influences in that early stage of my life that led me 3 years later, from when this comic first came out, to take those first steps on to the old front line. So Charlie's War was scripted by writer Pat Mills, who's still around. You'll find him on Twitter. And it was drawn by Joe Cahoon. Pat Mills was a young writer, highly politicised, incredibly left-wing, probably describe him as Marxist, really. If you look at his Twitter feed, you'll kind of get a sense of that even now. And Joe was a Second World War veteran who had been involved in illustrating comics since the early 1950s. So he was kind of the veteran in more ways than one of the two of them. And his art style was really quite different. The kind of depth of detail and the faces and the way he captured, for me, when I look back on it, the way he captured landscape and the whole essence of the First World War, that was really something quite special. The Charlie's War series ran from 1979 to 1986. Pat Mills pulled out towards the end and a different writer came in for the final year. And sadly, Joe Cahoon died in 1987. So the success of Charlie's War was relatively short, just a few years, but probably was quite a long-running comic strip in the history of comic books. I'm not an expert on those. I think the impact that it had on people like me of that generation who were teenagers coming into that period, probably when we were moving away from reading comics. I mean, I remember being a university student and still buying this from the newsagent to read. Such was the impact. It was the only reason I bought the comic was to read Charlie's War. So it had this, despite being short-lived, it had this big impact. And I think I've spoken to so many people on Twitter, on battlefield tours, and through this podcast, for which Charlie's War remains, like me, this great influence. So the series told the story of one soldier, a young soldier, what we'd now call, thanks to writers like Richard Van Emden, we'd call a teenage Tommy. And that soldier was Charlie Bourne. Now, when I was reading this comic strip, I had only a handful of books on the First World War. And here I am more than four decades later, and I look and I've reread the whole strip in the three volumes that have been reprinted as part of the research for this podcast. And I can see so many of the influences on Pat Mills and Joe Calhoun, who illustrated it, in the way that they told this story. And to give the lead character the name Bourne is one of those, because that was the lead character in Frederick Manning's Her Private's We, Middle Parts of Fortune. That was his surname, Private Bourne. So I think there's a kind of good nod to the literature of the First World War in the very beginning of this comic strip. And Charlie Bourne is a young lad from London. He's not the cleverest of lad, which he acknowledges right kind of throughout the comic strip. It's often said by some of those who commanded him that we don't need intellectuals, we need tough young lads like him who can do the right thing at the right time. And what happens is he lies about his age and joins up. And because this is, you know, a comic strip, it's a piece of fiction, not a documentary or some great study of the First World War, there's a lot of compacting of detail and timelines to make the story possible. So he joins up, teenage Tommy, in the early part of 1916 and is in the trenches of the Somme pretty quickly. And he goes from the Somme through to Passchendaele, through to the Armistice. He's wounded, he's gassed, he's taken prisoner at one point and escapes. And in the kind of final series of the story, the Second World War comes around and he goes off and takes part in the Battle of France and the retreat to Dunkirk. Charlie Bourne, from the point of view of the writers and illustrator, is a kind of First World War everyman. They use him to tell the wider story of the First World War. And when you look at all the things that he did, probably that would be impossible for any ordinary soldier that actually served in the war, but that's kind of not really the purpose of this comic strip. It was to educate a young generation, young minds, in the history of a war that was by then, in the late 70s and early 80s, already beginning to fade away, with the generation of veterans rapidly disappearing. And I'd like to say that in that they certainly achieve, because here we are decades later still talking about this. It's something that's still in print, and I'd hope that it will continue to have an inspiration, a connection, and will take perhaps new generations on to discover more about the First World War. The script throughout, though, of course, plays to the background and nuances of the writer, and the writer, Pat Mills, being a highly politicised individual, you see his views, wider views, coming through in the way the story is told. So it's an anti-war story. It expresses the futility of war, often the pointlessness of how people are killed, sometimes seemingly for nothing. And it taps into what was then a prevalent view, which is the war was about lions led by donkeys, these amazing soldiers on the front line let down by the higher-ups. And, you know, a left-wing Marxist like Pat Mills, that is the kind of viewpoint that you would expect. But although there's lots in that from an historical point of view that I'm going to disagree with, I still feel that it doesn't really damage the impact of what this story is about, because it's the way that it expresses the human story, the human experience of war, that's one of its most endearing characteristics. And also that you get a lot in this, going back to kind of Pat Mills' views, there's a lot of class war. So the ordinary soldiers are good, the officers are bad. Occasionally there's a couple of good officers, but most of them are idiots who are trying to kind of pull one over on the ordinary soldiers and making sure that they survive at the expense of others. That's a common theme in many of these stories. And of course, you know, if we look at the history of the Great War, we don't have to go far to kind of find actual stories like this. So it's not an untruth, but I think it's an exaggeration done for the purpose of the storyline. So Charlie's War isn't perfect. I'd never claim that. But I think it still stands the test of time and still is worthy of our consideration. And I think one of the clever bits when I've reread the whole series is that Charlie's War starts on the Somme, and that's a really big part of establishing what the story was about. But it goes on to cover so many other aspects of the Great War, and Charlie Bourne isn't in all of them, but cleverly they interact him with other people, and we learn about different parts of the Great War. He meets a British volunteer in the French Foreign Legion, and we discover the story of Verdun, and through one of his relatives we have the war at sea. His brother is involved in the war in the air over the Western Front and also back home on the home front. There's quite a lot about the home front. And then post-armistice, Charlie goes off and he takes part in the Russian Civil War. So there's a lot of different elements to this story and a lot of different pathways that takes Charlie Bourne, or people that Charlie Bourne meets, takes us through those experiences as well. So it was in many respects quite an education about the wider aspects of the First World War. And like I say, I really do think it was an inspirational comic strip. I've seen it described as one of the greatest comic strips ever made. And because it's been reprinted, and I'll put details of those reprints onto the podcast website, I hope that it is something that will continue to be part of the kind of greater canon, really, of the studies of the First World War. And I think graphic novels have their place in our understanding of that conflict, something that we will return to with some wider graphic novels from different countries in that later episode. So what will we do here in this one? We can't go through 7 years of comics, comic by comic, and that would be pointless, really. But what we will do is pick out some key aspects of the storyline and discuss those. So let's head off and look at what Charlie's War was all about. So what are we going to do in this episode about the comic strip Charlie's War? Now, as we've said, we can't go through comic by comic every single episode of it, because it's a wide, wide story and there are lots and lots of different editions of it. But what we're going to do is look at some key aspects, three main parts of the story of Charlie Bourne in the Great War, and look at what they tell us about that conflict, and look at how the story of Charlie Bourne developed and the kind of impacts that it had. And what we'll do is take three particular periods of the war to get an insight into this comic strip. We'll look at the Somme, we'll look at Charlie Bourne in the Battle of Passchendaele, the Third Battle of Ypres in 1917, and we'll look at Charlie Bourne on the last day of the First World War, on the 11th of November 1918. And we'll end with how the series connected to my own journey across to the Western Front and those criss-cross paths of the Great War battlefields that we often discuss here. So the cartoon series begins with the chief, the main character, Charlie Bourne, working in London. He's a young lad, only 16, and he's working at a bus depot. It's clear from the very beginning that he has a particular connection, a particular fondness for horses. This was at a time in which the kind of bus and tram routes of London were moving from using horses to becoming more automated, but many of them had horses. And we see Charlie with the depot's horse and having a very good kind of relationship with it. Charlie's shown to be a simple lad, not stupid, but easily led occasionally, particularly in the early years of his service before the realities of trench warfare and the war on the Western Front really kind of strike him and turn him into a very different kind of man. And his less than kind workmates convince him that the War Office has called up the depot nag, Fred, who is the horse they've got at the depot there. And they tell him that Charlie must go with the horse and join the army, and he's got to go and report to the manager's office. He takes the horse into the manager's office with him, and of course this is just a joke on Charlie's part. The manager's furious, and Charlie is sacked. So this is the spring of 1916, and Charlie, now at a loose end with no job, has seen the war unfold around him, and he decides to join up. He joins up underage, he reports at a recruiting office, he lies about his age, he says he's 18, but the recruiting sergeant notes that he gives his year of birth as 1900, and the sergeant major who's there with him says something along the lines of, well, we don't need clever soldiers, we need tough soldiers, let him in. And he passes muster and he joins the army. Now, they then, in terms of the storyline, a normal soldier recruited at that kind of period of the war would not have got across to the Western Front really before much towards the end of the Battle of the Somme, if not towards the end of that year. But to get Charlie into the place that they need him for this story, he joins up, does his training, and very quickly goes to the Western Front and arrives on the Somme in June of 1916, only weeks, days away, really, from the big offensive. In the trenches, we soon see him discover the realities of war. It's not a romantic tale, this one, Charlie's War, and any romanticism that Charlie has about military service quickly dissipates as he sees people getting killed around him. He sees the horses in particular that greatly affects him. That's one of the main recurring storylines with Charlie. He's always going out to rescue an animal somewhere, particularly a horse, and horses figure strongly in several different aspects of the stories in this comic strip. But once in the trenches, he realises that the conditions are tough, that the dead are everywhere, he sees men get killed, and he encounters men who've been there for quite some time who often have terrible tales to tell. And then he also meets one of the key central figures in the story that stands by him really throughout his war experiences, and that's Old Bill, Sergeant Tozer. He's a regular soldier, he's the platoon sergeant, he's tattooed, heavily tattooed, like many regular soldiers were. There's a great episode where he kind of does a turn on the stage, where he takes his shirt off and he's got a dreadnought tattooed on his chest with the barrel of the gun around his belly button, and he's able to fire peas from there and launch shells across the ranks of soldiers sitting in this barn behind the lines. It's quite a character. I mean, in some respects he is a caricature of a typical sergeant, regular soldier, but it's a really fantastic character that shares the experiences that Charlie has in these many battles of the Great War. And we discover too that even Sergeant Tozer has his own breaking points as that story unfolds over the years of the war on the Western Front. And by the end of it, he becomes a great friend to Charlie. He's the one who stands by his side and sticks up for him on so many occasions. And he becomes like a father figure, really. The age difference between them is a really significant part of the bonds, I think, that they have, which reflected, I'm sure, a lot of soldiers' experiences in the Great War. So it was very well observed in that respect. So what do we find in this comic strip of the pre-Somme period? We haven't got to the point where they've gone over the top yet. We have a very good depiction of the trenches and the artistry showing what the trenches look like. The detail is really superb, with fire steps and dugouts and machine gun positions and observation saps and the way the wire is placed in front of the trenches and the depiction of no man's land, not just this vast shell smash landscape, but flowers and wildflowers like poppies growing up amongst the barbed wire and on the lips of the shell craters. It really creates a landscape, and it depicts a landscape that is very true to the experience of the First World War, and it's probably all part of my own fascination with landscape when it comes to this subject. Charlie as well, you quite early on, although he's a simple lad, you discover that he's an incredibly brave soldier. And one of the early stories is when he goes out to rescue a runner from a sniper, a German sniper who's in full trench armour with a steel faceplate firing at Tommies in no man's land and picking them off. And this is the first depiction of the men on the other side of the wire, the other side of no man's land, the Germans. And generally they're depicted as brave often, but cruel and often bad. I would say that despite Pat Mills' politics, you do get a sense that there is a justness in the war to defeat some kind of tyranny. And whether that was really a filter through more of the experience of the Second World War for both writer and artist, I guess considering their backgrounds, that's quite likely, really. In the final phase leading up to the offensive, there's a trench raid that Charlie Bourne takes part in. They get into the enemy positions. Charlie takes revenge on the sniper who'd shot so many Tommies in no man's land and kills him. And we discover more about his platoon officer, who is Lieutenant Thomas. Charlie likes him. He's seen as a very sympathetic figure. And Lieutenant Thomas goes down into the German dugouts that they get into when they get in these trenches on this raid and sees that they're deep. And he begins to worry that the bombardment will not do its job and the attack could be a catastrophe, could be a massacre. Now that, of course, does reflect actual history. There were such trench raids and there were officers who doubted the ability of the bombardment to do its job. If you look at the 9th Devons and the kind of cynicism that they had in the approach, fatalism almost that they had in the approach to the 1st of July, Lieutenant Colonel Sandys, who commanded the Middlesex Regiment in Mash Valley, he had warned that the bombardment might not be able to do its job and that the men would be killed, and nevertheless he led his men into no man's land. So again, it's reflecting real history. As always with fiction and something like this, it's an exaggeration of the truth, but it's there to tell a wider story. After the trench raid, the build-up to the Somme is shown in the comic strip. We see lots of images of men marching to the front, ammunition being piled up and guns being brought ready for the bombardment. And we meet some other characters that become some of the key characters in this early part of the story. Pops, who's an older soldier who had run a kind of pie and mash shop in London before the war. Both his sons had been gassed in the early phase of the war, and he joined up to revenge their deaths. There's Mick, the big mad Irishman, as he's described in the cartoon strip. Bit of a caricature, a physically big, tough soldier, but with a heart of gold, and he'll do anything for those that he likes. And then there's Ginger, who becomes one of Charlie's mates through a long period of this early phase of the story. They get a pre-battle talk by a general who turns up to talk to their regiment. Now, there's a fictionalised regiment used for Charlie's war, the Royal Westshires, and I'm sure that they did this rather than present an actual real regiment. so that people didn't write in and say, well, that never happened to that regiment and there was no such thing in that particular battalion or whatever. This way they're fictionalising the kind of whole story, but giving it credibility by depicting a typical experience of a British battalion on the Somme. But the general assembles them and talks to them and he says, good luck, men. When you go over, you will find the wire has been destroyed. And of course, again, this reflects what happened before the 1st of July. Men were assembled like this. There are official photographs showing men in square formation round a senior officer being given a lecture like this. And they were told all kinds of things. Nothing will survive the bombardment, not even a rat. And that is a truism of that period leading up to the 1st of July 1916. But of course, there's a wider explanation from an historical point of view. It wasn't that the generals were dunderheads and they didn't know what they were doing. It was that probably everyone believed this, given the power of the bombardment that they were planning and the amount of shells that were stockpiled by the sides of the road. Everyone from private to general understandably believed that a bombardment like this would destroy the enemy positions. But that's kind of something that we've discussed in many other podcasts before, and we don't need to go over here. But I think it reflects not just Pat Mills' politics, but I think it does reflect the truth of the 1st of July, that this was a feeling in the approach to the battle that it was going to be some kind of walkover, cakewalk, that the bombardment had been got right this time and this huge amount of forces assembled, that through overwhelming strength from artillery and men, it would be a big push that would result in victory in 1916. About this time, Charlie meets another officer in the story, Lieutenant Snell, who is very different to his platoon officer, Lieutenant Thomas. He's a nasty piece of work, and he really becomes Charlie's nemesis throughout the story on the Western Front. And then very soon, we've reached 0 hour on the 1st of July 1916. The men are being told that it will be a walkover, but what they see is very different. They're not in the first wave of the attack. They watch the first waves go over. And it doesn't depict an actual place on the battlefield as such. It's not Montauban, it's not Gommecourt, it's not La Boisselle. It's a generic place. And they weave in stories, well-known stories. So when Charlie and his mates are watching those early waves go forward, we see a group of men with a pennant on a stick and it reads, the Leeds POWs. Now, that, of course, for us, immediately says Sayre and the attack of the POWs battalions there. But I think the whole point of this is to tell a wider story. So as well as watching the Leeds POWs, in inverted commas, go forward, in the same area, Charlie and his mates see the East Surreys kick footballs into battle. So they're compressing the stories of the 1st of July into one place. And that's understandable in the context of this being a story designed for children, because you want to tell those wider stories to engage that young audience that you have. Charlie's shown in the frontline trenches with Pops, that older soldier who's joined up to avenge his sons, encouraging Charlie. And then they contrast this on the other side of no man's land with a German version of Pops encouraging a young German machine gunner to avenge his comrades. They've emerged from their dugouts after all those days of trommel fire, drum fire, and they're setting up their weapons to greet the Allied, the British attack. So it kind of shows that there is a symmetry between the experience of these men, that they're caught up in this greater struggle. And again, I think this tips a nod to Pat Mills' politics, believing that this was kind of a class war in which these were all pawns in someone's greater game. But I think also we can put that to one side and understand that there is a kind of symmetry here, that there were men on both sides of no man's land believing that they were fighting for the same things and expressing the same kind of ideas and feelings when it came to battle. Charlie sees the horror of going into battle when one of his comrades gets caught on the barbed wire and is killed by machine gun fire. And that fear of getting caught on the wire, hanging on the old barbed wire, is something that comes across in many, many soldiers' memoirs of the First World War. But their attack is not cut down in no man's land, as was so often the case on the 1st of July. Charlie's platoon gets into the German trenches, but they have a flamethrower used against them. Now, those kind of flamethrowers I've never seen any kind of record of those being used on the 1st of July against British troops. But this, again, is all part of building that story of the horror of the Great War and that black and white cartoon depiction of the effect of a Flammenwerfer, a flamethrower, being used against Tommies in the close confines of the trenches. To my young mind, that had a great effect on me. And I think rereading it as an adult, as a middle-aged man, I kind of have the same feeling. It depicts the horror of that quite brutally, but very well, if that's the kind of right phrase for it. And then Pops, once he's in the German trenches facing the Germans, his desire for vengeance comes out, and he wants to take out as many Germans as he can in revenge for the loss of his two boys who died in that poison gas attack in 1915. And he takes his bayonet to a prisoner of war. Charlie steps in, stops Pops from killing this young lad, the machine gunner, until Lieutenant Snell turns up and shoots him dead with his revolver. And we see for the first time just how brutal and cruel Lieutenant Snell is. And that becomes a dominant theme in his interactions with Charlie over much of the rest of the series. The attack then continues with Charlie's platoon fighting their way from the trenches into a nearby village. Mick, the big Irishman, he's after a pickelhauber and he tells Charlie to look out for them. And then we see a scene where Germans are shown preparing a pickelhauber as a booby trap by strapping a grenade to it. Now, again, that's an interesting kind of insight. One of the veterans that I interviewed, who was at Gomercourt on the 1st of July, Aubrey Rose, he recounted that one of his mates was after a pickelhauber and went down into a dugout there when they got into the German lines, lifted it up by the spike, and there was a cord coming from underneath, strapped to a stick grenade underneath the table, and that went off and killed him instantly. In this case, it doesn't kill Mick, but it very badly wounds him, and he's evacuated into a regimental aid post in the cellar of one of the buildings. And the building comes under tremendous bombardment. It begins to shatter and break, and the roof timbers are coming down, and Mick finds superhuman strength from somewhere to hold those timbers up. Charlie gets out the wounded, the others help him, and coming in through one of the tunnels leading into this cellar is a load of Germans ready to reap their revenge and retake this position. And just as they burst in, Mick lets the roof collapse on top of them and they're all killed. Mick saves the day. And Charlie returns later that evening to the ruins of that building where Mick now lies beneath and puts up a little sign tipping a nod to a wider story of the first day of the Somme. He puts a little sign that he writes in his very basic English, "Mad Mick holds this house and holds it still," and nods to the Devonshires and their trench. The Devonshires held this trench, the Devonshires hold it still. And I think that's the genius, really, of Charlie's War, is that it's able to tell these stories and bring in this Great War culture and the language that the First World War has for us and really present it in a new way to a young audience to engage them. But if we look at the depiction of the first day of the Battle of the Somme, what does it really tell us about the 1st of July 1916? Well, it is a comic, it is fiction, that's not me making an excuse for it, but it's trying to tell a story. Not all details are correct with the Surreys and the Leeds Powers being on the same part of the battlefield. But what it's doing is telling this everyman story with Charlie Bourne at the centre of it, of that opening stage of the offensive, this vast number of volunteers, keen and ready for battle, and they get sent into battle, and from Pat Mill's point of view, they're let down by the higher-ups who command them, and it results in these terrible, catastrophic casualties. And while we can challenge that viewpoint with the revisionist point of view of the history of the First World War, I still think that what Charlie's War does is personalise the war through these individual characters and gives us an insight in a way that I think that other things can't. I think this is where fiction like this has its place in our understanding of subjects like the First World War. And for me, I think it created this deep, deep interest in the Battle of the Somme. There was always something about the Somme, the things that I'd read, the way that my grandmother could remember the wounded coming back from the Somme covered in Somme chalk at a local station, going to the military hospitals in Colchester where she lived. There was always something about the Somme for me, and I think this story of Charlie in this opening phase of the Battle of the Somme really cemented that importance of the Somme in my own journey a few years later to those Somme battlefields. I went to Ypres first, as you know, if you listen to this podcast, I had to get to the Somme. So as soon as I went to eat with my school, I persuaded my dad, and we went over on the train to Dieppe and took the train down to the Somme, and we walked those Somme battlefields. And in the back of my mind as we walked were these stories of Charlie's War, that depiction of the Great War landscape. And for Charlie, this is not the end of his experience in the Somme. The story unravels further, and we see Charlie being involved in the cavalry attack at High Wood a couple of weeks later. There's the story of Shot at Dawn is brought into this. Now, that was one of the earliest depictions of military executions, and certainly I would guess probably the first depiction of it in any kind of children's literature. And that's an important milestone. I think that when I was reading that, I had no idea that British soldiers were executed like that. And it's the story of his officer, Lieutenant Thomas, who gets them out of a tricky situation in the front line, is accused of abandoning his post, and the evidence is against him, and he's found guilty and executed, and Charlie is part of the firing squad. So really, for a story aimed at teenagers, already in the first few months of this story going out, we've had men killed by flamethrowers, blown apart on the battlefields, and now shot by firing squad as well. So it was brutal in one way, but I think the honesty of it was something that made us as readers believe in the story, think it was credible because of this honesty. If it presented the war as some kind of joke, I don't think it would ever have had the impact that it did. And there was one particular episode of Charlie's War that I remember which kind of brought the Battle of the Somme to an end. And I'm looking at that illustration now. It shows a line of smiling Tommies coming down a hill. And as they get towards the bottom, the figures are beginning to fade. And to the right of the illustration is a depiction of a Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemetery. And at the front, the headstone of a soldier of the Great War known unto God, with the date 1st of July 1916 beneath it. And I remember really strongly reading that for the first time as a teenager. The caption says, "The soldiers who died were all volunteers, the first to volunteer, lads eager to serve their country. They were young, healthy and brave, the best of British." And then we get a kind of sense of what Pat Mills really thinks about it. He says, "Ironically, the battle was hailed as a great victory. 500,000 Tommies like Charlie were killed or wounded in the Battle of the Somme. The total gain was 7 miles and 3 villages. Well, I mean, we can challenge the kind of figures there. There were a lot more than 3 villages captured on the Somme. But when I look at this, and considering that this was on the tipping point for my own journey to visit these battlefields, to see this cemetery, and there's a memorial plaque illustrated there as well. Thomas Atkins is the name that's placed in the little box where the name should be. But it is a real depiction of a First World War bronze memorial plaque. And not long after this, I remember going to Brighton Market and seeing one on the store. I bought my first ever memorial plaque, Lancelot George Thomas Usher. He was killed with the Royal Fusiliers in 1914 in the fighting up near Le Bassay. And it was 50p, which was the value placed on a memorial plaque for that time. But my knowledge of what that was and the importance of it came from this comic strip. And I think that's really, for me, why this is such an important story, not just in my own route to the Great War, but I think in so many others. So that's the Battle of the Somme. That's one element of Charlie's story in the Great War. We'll go on to look at Passchendaele and the last day of World War I. We move on to another depiction of a key aspect of the Great War in Charlie's War, and that's the Third Battle of Ypres, or Passchendaele, as many people call it. In the meantime, between the Somme and Third Ypres, Charlie has been wounded and sent home. We learn a lot about the home front through that. He meets a French deserter, an Englishman who's joined the French Foreign Legion. That's when we hear about the story of Verdun and the battle at Fort Vaux. And the depictions of that really are quite something. That's probably worth a podcast discussion in its own right in many respects. Perhaps some of our French historians out there might kind of look at that themselves down the line. Sergeant Tozer, that key character, Old Bill, loses his stripes thanks to Lieutenant Snell. And at Messines, Snell and Charlie clash in the tunnels beneath the Messines Ridge. Charlie works with the tunnellers. This is how we kind of discover so many aspects, different aspects of the First World War, through Charlie himself being drawn into these things. And in those tunnels beneath the ridge, he encounters Snell, who wants to blow a mine after the attack has begun and potentially kill thousands of Tommies who have already gone over the top. And Snell accidentally shoots himself in trying to defend himself against what we think is Charlie, but actually is another character, as a group of them that have gone down there to try and silence and stop Snell. Snell fires his pistol, the bullet ricochets and hits him in the head, and he's not dead. He's evacuated off, but they think that's the last they'll see of him. And then after Messines, Third Ypres itself is approaching, the Royal Westshires go over the top on the morning of the 31st of July 1917, and Charlie, in the lead up to it, has nightmares about being caught on the wire. Now, you've got to remember, he's been at the front now for well over a year. He's been wounded, he's been shell-shocked, he's seen so many of his mates get killed. He's a hardened veteran in terms of what this story is about, but yet the effects of the war are often creeping up on him. And he's having this recurring dream of getting caught on the wire, just like he'd seen on the first day of the Somme with one of his mates. And it nearly happens. He does get caught on the wire in this attack, but he's freed and is not killed. And what we see has happened on the 31st of July, it's a successful attack. That day was a very successful operation for the British Army. It took most of its objectives, not without loss, but of course the weather changed and it turned that battlefield into this lunar landscape of shell holes created by the bombardment, and then the mixture of the wet weather and the nature of the ground turned that into one of the worst battlefields on which British soldiers fought in terms of the conditions throughout the Great War. And that's very cleverly depicted in the pages of Charlie's War. Now, we had an episode recently about the pillboxes of Flanders, and pillboxes were very much part, concrete bunkers were very much part of the story of the Third Battle of Ypres, and Charlie's War brings them into that, where they've advanced, they've captured the German positions, they're pushing on. It's all been very successful, but then failure is just round the corner, and hiding amongst the trees and the detritus of the landscape are these hidden bunkers we see depicted. Now, it wasn't really like that. If we look at images of the Third Battle of Ypres, the bombardment that smashed the landscape and these concrete structures stood out like monoliths on the battlefield. In many respects, a lot of soldiers felt they were shell magnets in the way that they could be visibly seen and bombarded because both sides were trying to knock them out, depending on who was inside. But we see a storyline here where Charlie's platoon advance and are kind of ambushed, really, by a line of pillboxes which are bristling with machine guns. One bunker in the story seems to surrender. Germans come out waving white flags, and the platoon advances towards it and into man traps that are laid on the grounds. These metal traps that the men put their feet into, and it crushes their feet. Now, there were examples of those being used in the trenches of the Western Front. Often when one side would pull back from a trench as they knew the enemy were about to overrun it, they would lay traps like this, or they'd have wooden boards with caltrops on them, and these are a Roman invention that you throw them down, and they're designed so that when they land there will always be a spike pointing up. They'd often fix a load of those to a board, drop that board into the bottom of the trench, and when men leapt over the parapet into the trench, they'd land down on top of them. Now, there are many examples of this happening at different points in the First World War. Man traps being placed like this, perhaps less so. But the key thing here is the German treachery. They've lured the Tommies in, thinking that the Germans are about to surrender, but there's man traps, and then the machine guns open up again, and the officer falls and men are dropping left and right all round him. And then what we see is that Charlie and his comrades see red, advance rapidly on the bunker, and no prisoners are taken. And when I reread this, it reminded me of the exploits of Edward Cooper, VC, of the King's Royal Rifle Corps in the attack on the Au Bon Gite bunker near Langemarck. Time-wise, this is probably kind of similar to the story depicted in Charlie's War. Edward Cooper was a veteran of the Great War that I interviewed, the only VC recipient of the Great War that I ever met. And he did a similar thing, that his unit approached this multi-tiered machine gun bunker and the machine gun fire was cheering up the ranks of his company, and he saw Red armed only with a pistol and a couple of grenades. He charged the bunker and he took it out and wasn't too keen on taking prisoners because of what they'd done to his mates who were lying dead on the battlefield behind him. So again, I think that these stories do reflect very well the true stories of the Great War, and that it shows that both author and illustrator had done a huge amount of research to make these stories, in my mind, so credible. And then, of course, with 30, with Passchendaele, you can't ignore the mud. The story has to involve the mud. And the next phase of this part of Charlie's War very much is about that, the conditions on the battlefield. Charlie finds his brother Wilf, who he didn't even know had joined up. He's also joined up underage. And he finds him lying on the lip of a shell crater. He thinks he's a dead Tommy. He turns him over and he sees it's his brother Wilf. There's a Lewis gun lying beside him. And he gets Wilf away back to an advanced dressing station. And he saves his life. He carries him to a bunker that's being used as a dressing station. They say, look, he's dead already, son, just leave him. And he can't do that, so he carries on. As he walks away from the bunker, a shell goes in and everyone is killed inside. And again, that reflects what actually happened during the Third Battle of Ypres. There's a story in the South Downs battalions of the Royal Sussex Regiment. I have the medals of a stretcher bearer who was killed in a bunker like that when they had their aid post in the bunker and shells came in through what had been the back door, was now the front door facing the Germans, and everyone inside was killed by the blast of the shell. So all of these stories where they weave in the actual events of the Great War is what gives Charlie's War its depth, in my view. And after Charlie has taken his brother Wilf to a dressing station that will treat him, and he is alive, he saves his brother's life. He has a run-in with the battle police because he's not got a chit to say that he's there as a stretcher bearer recovering the wounded. And he gets away from them and then falls into a water-filled shell hole, and he can't get out. And it looks as if he's going to drown in the liquid mud of Passchendaele. And it's a bank holiday at this point, and he thinks of his family on the beach. And I remember, again, reading this, the depiction of Charlie in this water filled, this muddy shell hole at Ypres, contrasted with the family sitting on the beach at Hastings or Eastbourne or wherever it was. It had a great effect on me, kind of seeing that contrast between the soldier and civilian, the gap between their experiences and what those at home experienced or didn't experience, as the case may be, and how that gap created this impossibility, really, of them ever being able to explain that. So it was one of those moments in the story, I think, that had a great, great kind of impact on me, and an insight, really, into the experience of war and how difficult it was for soldiers often to relate that. But Charlie doesn't disappear into the mud, of course he doesn't. And there are some more stories during Third Ypres. But in the interim, after he's got out this shell hole, he heads off to Etaples and he takes part in the mutiny, which again, the kind of whole politics behind that really plays into the background of Pat Mills, the writer. But as I say, we can't cover every aspect of every story in Charlie's War. So we'll jump now from the muddy shell holes and the bunkers of Third Ypres to the very last day of the First World War, the 11th of November 1918. Charlie's long war has continued in the meantime. Along the way, he almost meets Adolf Hitler when his regiment comes up against Hitler's regiment at one particular point. He meets a nurse and gets married. He gets taken prisoner and escapes. And following that head wound in the tunnels at Messines in 1917, despite being committed as insane, his old nemesis, Captain Snell, is back in command of Charlie's unit. Now, Mills and Colquhoun couldn't resist a 11th of November 1918 story. If you're telling a story that in your mind is to depict the futility of war, what better example of that, I would guess, than an attack that goes in the last moments of the conflict? And of course, whether they knew that or not, this did depict a reality, as we unravelled in our documentary in 2008, The Last Day of World War One, with Michael Palin, when we explored these stories of that final moments of the conflict. So it did happen, there were attacks. And with the recent All Quiet on the Western Front film that we've seen, they couldn't resist an 11th of November 1918 story either. So what, in particular, the writer Pat Mills is doing here is ramming home one of his central themes, really, that is the pointlessness of war, the pointlessness of the Great War in his mind. And I think that that is something that still prevails even to this day. You've only got to look at Facebook groups to see that comment expressed. And it's difficult, really, to find meaning in sacrifice. And I think that's why it's so important to study the Great War in some depth, to discover what that meaning meant to those who were actually there, rather than put our own 20th and late 20th and early 21st century perspectives on what we think their meaning of sacrifice was and what we think our meaning of their sacrifice was. If you look at how they viewed it, I think it's very different to how many people view it today, and very different to how Pat Mills viewed it when he wrote this comic strip. But what we find is that Charlie's regiment is on the outskirts of Mons. Of course it's on the outskirts of Mons. Old Bill, Sergeant Tozer's back in the ranks with them. He's fought there at Mons in 1914, so his war has come full circle. And there's only 1 hour of the war left. And in that final hour of the war, the mad, crazy Captain Snell orders an attack. And they show him getting up onto a parapet, saying, "For the last time, men, over the top." Now, of course, this didn't really depict the realities of combat on the last day of the war. There were no trenches. It was open warfare. When they got to Mons, it was urban warfare, really, where they were fighting amongst the terrace streets. The last Canadian killed was in one of those terrace streets at 10:58, 2 minutes before the armistice came into effect. But obviously this is a generic kind of First World War story. Perhaps they weren't aware. Many people aren't aware of kind of the nature of the fighting in those last weeks of the Great War. But it shows them going into battle. The Germans can hardly believe what they're seeing. They know that the war's coming to an end. The Germans open up with their machine guns, and Charlie watches soldier after soldier in his platoon, in his company, get mown down in this pointless last attack of the Great War. Charlie gets to the German positions, but seemingly only him and Captain Snell are left. It looks as if old Bill has been killed as well. And this really breaks Charlie. Charlie's stepped over a line. Captain Snell has stepped over a line. This is too much. So Charlie and Snell have this final battle, that nemesis of Charlie Bourne's. It was always coming to this point where it was going to be do or die. And as 11 o'clock sounds on the church bells in the distance, they're fighting to the death. And as it seems that Snell has the upper hand, it's clear that he doesn't want to kill Charlie, because he reveals that he's volunteered Charlie for the Russian Expeditionary Force. So without his knowledge, without his consent, he's put Charlie on a list that's going to take him away from the Western Front as this war's coming to an end, to another war fighting the Russians on the Eastern Front in that Russian Civil War following the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917. And at that moment, a German pops up with an acid sprayer, hits Snell, and he dies a terrible, gruesome death. Charlie possibly could have saved him, put him out of his misery, but he walks away as Snell expires, and Charlie's nemesis is no more. As he walks back to the battlefield to see the fallen bodies of his comrades, he finds that Sergeant Tozer is still alive, and that he too has signed up for Russia. And that's where the story then continues beyond the armistice to the fighting in the Russian Civil War. But finally, Charlie's fighting days are over and he comes home. The final story in the comic strip is set in 1933. Charlie is on the dole, that terrible interwar period when so many veterans promised homes fit for heroes came back to nothing, not even a job, not a home, just unemployment, misery, poverty, a cruel betrayal of everything that they'd done. And he meets old Bill once more, who hasn't seen for years. He's now a commissionaire at a local cinema, and they have a few beers together in the local pub. And it ends with Charlie walking away, thinking about the war, thinking about his past and his comrades, and with a newspaper seller standing on the street proclaiming that Hitler had just been elected. And it's clear that the inference is another war, another conflict is just around the corner. And I guess their point there was to echo what many veterans must have felt during that period of the 1930s. What was it all for? There's that memoir, And All For What? And All For What? What was the sacrifice about if another war was approaching? And in those later, those final elements of the comic strip, Charlie is in that war as a soldier in the British Expeditionary Force in the Battle of France and Dunkirk. So what does Charlie's War, a children's comic strip, tell us about the Great War? Well, on one level, very little, because it's not an official history. It's not one of these great volumes that tells us about a particular battle or the whole war on the Western Front. But then on another level, it gives us a lot, because it tells us the human story of conflict, the human experience of conflict, what it does to men to serve in battles like the Somme and Passchendaele and so many others that Charlie Bourne and his comrades were a part of. And when you think that Pat Mills and Joe Colquhoun, their purpose was to create through Charlie Bourne and every man who goes through the war and to tell that story of the war through him, certainly in that they succeed. The history isn't always right. A lot of it we might challenge all these years later, but I do not believe that that diminishes in any way the power of this story and the power, I think, as well of this medium, because it's not a novel, it's not poetry, it's not a great sacred tome that tells the tales of the war. It's a very simple approach to storytelling, but a very, very powerful one. And I think back to how it affected me, how so many times in those early years of exploring the Great War, I often looked at what I saw through the lens of Charlie Bourne, of Charlie's War. I realised just how much it had affected me. And when I came to interview those veterans in the 1980s and 90s, there was a man who had actually been in the Great War telling me stories of the like that I'd read in a comic strip as a teenager. And I think that's when I began to realise just how much there was behind this thing. I mean, it's disposable in some ways as a child's comic, but there's so much more to it than that. And I'm so pleased that these volumes have been reprinted. You can sit there with the three gorgeous paperbacks and go through them. They've got a lot of coloured illustrations showing the covers and some of the colour artwork that was done for it, and then notes by Pat Mills on quite a few of the different episodes. I haven't gone through those for this because I really wanted this to be about my own view of Charlie's War rather than other people's. And there's some really good websites out there where people have analysed some of the characters and looked at some of the storylines. And I point you to all of that to kind of go and have a look at it. But Charlie's War was this monster of a story. It's like a war and peace, really, and all quiet on the Western Front for a young generation of readers. Charlie kind of does everything. He kind of experiences everything, goes through everything in that second half of the Great War. And of course, that would be impossible for one man. But this is a vehicle by which those writers and illustrators can inform us about what the Great War was all about. And they don't get it right all the time. But the essence of the Great War is in the pages of these comic strips, and always will be, in my view. And I think the fact that Charlie Bourne was a teenage Tommy, he was 16, then young readers like myself could identify more with him. And today, even today, school groups go to the battlefields and they visit the graves of lads like Valentine Joe Strudwick, who died at Ypres, age 15. And teenagers now, who are studying the Great War and go on these battlefield trips, they can feel connected to an event that feels very distant, very much in the past to them, through the fact that young people like them of their age were there too. It wasn't an old man's war. And I don't think Charlie's War, the comic strip, would have had the same impact if Charlie had been a lad in his 20s, for example. The fact that he was 16 was hugely significant to the audience that read that comic strip in the late 70s and early 80s. As you've gathered from this podcast, I love Charlie's War. I never tire of it. And it's been so pleasurable reading those volumes again from start to finish. And I would say that it really is worth your while to get those books, to read those books. It will add another of those layers to you. This is a genre, graphic novels, that we are going to return to in this podcast, to look at how other nations have used this genre to tell the story of the Great War. And it's not just a modern phenomena. One of those that we'll look at is a book that came out in the interwar period, telling the story of an Austro-Hungarian soldier in the Great War through a kind of a comic strip. More of that in a future podcast episode this season. But I wanted just to end with one little storyline. 1983, I was still reading this 4 years into Charlie's War being published. I was now in my last couple of years at school. I'd gone to Ypres, I'd gone to the Somme. I joined the Western Front Association. And there was one little storyline where Charlie had witnessed an aircraft crash on the battlefields near Ypres, and the pilot had survived, and Charlie picked him up, put him in a wheelbarrow, and took him down the Menin Road to take him to a dressing station, and a shell drops close by as they get to Hellfire Corner, and the pilot survives, but it's not clear what's happened to Charlie. And then it jumps to the present day, the 1980s, and the pilot is now a veteran who's gone on a battlefield tour, and there are two editions of the comic which follow him on this tour, and we see those Great War battlefields that we know so well depicted in the pages of Charlie's War. Vancouver Corner, Tyne Cot, the Menin Gate, Ypres. And there's one really incredible sequence where him and a Cockney veteran, who it transpires had served in the same regiment as Charlie, are sitting side by side in the coach, and they look at the modern view of Ypres that by then I knew already so well. And their mind flickers back to the past, back to 1917, when Ypres was a city of ruins. It's a very powerful couple of episodes, this one. And it had a great effect on me. It made me realise that there was a connection to all of this. That I wasn't just visiting the battlefield as some kind of voyeur, that I was connecting the history of the Great War to the landscape as it was today. And that's something that I've continued to do ever since, that we all do when we travel to those places, this big jigsaw that we often talk about, where we fit all those pieces together, and probably will never ever finish that, but we find so much along the way to interest us and inspire us. And I was so excited when this storyline came out that I remember taking the two comics down to the library in Crawley, which had a photocopier, and photocopying them and popping them in the post to John Giles, who was the then president and founder of the Western Front Association, who had been very good to me when I joined. I'd written to him and said, I'm only 15, but I'm passionate about the Great War. And he sent me this fantastic letter back where he was so pleased that somebody from the younger generation had joined and that I was to come and speak to him at the first meeting that I went to. And I did, and he made a big fuss, and he did so much for me and so many others. The whole of the Western Front Association in those days was a very different kind of organisation, in which that generation of people who had experienced the last war were doing as much as possible to remember those from the Great War. And when I used to go to the meetings that they organised, which were at the National Army Museum in London, the first two rows were always set out especially for veterans and were always full. There was a couple of dozen Great War veterans there every single time, and I was lucky to meet men who had written books about the Great War because of this: Charles Carrington, Norman Gladden, and Herbert Sulzbach, for example. So I sent these copies of this comic depicting the battlefields to John Giles, and probably thought that he would politely reply and say thank you, and that would be it. He wouldn't get it, because there I was as a teenager and this meant so much to me, and probably it wouldn't be the same to him. But he wrote back incredibly enthusiastic, so pleased that the message of the Great War and something trying to connect people to the Great War was now reaching this young audience, and he hoped that it would bring forward many others like me then to become members of the Western Front Association and never forget that generation. So whenever I look back on that particular edition and I flick through it in the reprints and read it, it brought back a lot of fond memories, because something as simple as a comic strip, as disposable as a young person's comic, could take me from a passionate interest in the Great War to follow a path that would take me to those battlefields across the flatlands of Flanders, over those vast open fields of northern France that lose Richebourg and Neuve-Chapelle, and down those tree-lined lanes and dusty tracks on the downlands, the chalk downlands of the Somme. A simple story, but with so much depth to it. A story of a young man, Charlie Bourne, and his life, his sacrifice, and that whole generation would inspire me and probably countless other readers to walk that route onwards, ever onwards, to the old front line. You've been listening to an episode of The Old Front Line with me, military historian Paul Reed. You can follow me on Twitter at SomCor. You can follow the podcast at Old Front Line Pod. Check out the website at oldfrontline.co.uk, where you'll find lots of podcast extras and photographs and links to books that are mentioned in the podcast. And if you feel like supporting us, you can go to our Patreon page, patreon.com/oldfrontline, or support us on Buy Me a Coffee at buymeacoffee.com/oldfrontline. Links to all of these are on our website. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again soon.